So they give me this thing called diesel therapy. And diesel therapy, when they're really pissed off at you, mm-hmm. when they're transporting you from, say, Orlando back to Columbia, South Carolina, they stop at every county jail they possibly can along the way. It took me 2 weeks to get from Orlando back to Columbia. And what happens is you go through processing. So for those who have never been in jail before, processing at a county jail is 4, 6, 8 hours long.
Yeah.
And you sit your happy ass there on a concrete bench until they get through with you. You're dead tired. So they're doing that. As soon as I hit the bunk, next morning, pack your shit. We're moving again. And the idea is to wear you down emotionally and mentally and physically. And it works like a charm.
The following podcast is a Carolina Boys production. Welcome back, everyone, to Crime and Entertainment. I'm your host, Hollywood Wade. Now, today we have a treat for a guest that was Brett Johnson. Now, if you follow my YouTubes, I posted a video not too long ago that I did with Matt Cox, who's a former guest on Crime and Entertainment. I've been on his show as well, along with Brett. And that was the first time I'd ever met him. And I found out a little bit about his background. He was basically what you would consider the OG cyber criminal, the godfather of cybercrime, if you will. He was doing this shit before it was cool, I guess is the best way to put it. Long before the dark web, you had Brett Johnson. And he would eventually make the FBI's most wanted list, escape custody a few times, made a ton of money, married a stripper, and I'm not embellishing a bit. Just a wild, crazy story. I'm going to let him tell you better than I can because he's a hell of a storyteller. Let's get right into it here on Crime and Entertainment with Brett Johnson. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Crime and Entertainment. I have here a very fascinating individual, got a hell of a story. I guess, would you consider you like the OG cyber criminal?
You know, they say that.
Okay.
Now, I mean, maybe you could say that. The Secret Service called me the original internet godfather, so I guess so, yeah.
Well, we've had a few. I don't know if we've had any godfathers on the show. We've had a few mob guys, so you're fitting right in with the company here. Please welcome Brett Johnson.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on, Wade. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Now, we first met when we went on Matt Cox's show, and he kept saying the name Brett, but there was another guy that he had introduced me to named Brent. And I thought that was who was going to be on the show. Then we got on, and I'm like, oh, I don't know this guy. And then I started hearing your story, and I was like, I want to know a little bit more about this guy because you've got a hell of a story, man, for sure. And I want to, if you don't mind, we'll get into it here today. And I like to take it up from the top, especially when guests maybe don't have a backstory of our viewers. Tell us a little bit about early life and, growing up, and then we'll just kind of let things unfold.
Early life. Well, I'm from Eastern Kentucky. Place called Hazard. So if you've watched, last year, if you saw all those floods that were happening in Kentucky, mm-hmm. that's my hometown, Hazard, Kentucky. My dad was in the military. He was a captain, Army helicopter pilot. So I spent the formative part of my years, I spent traveling the planet. We lived 3 years in Germany, lived in most of the states across the United States. It gave me a really good worldview and insight into things that I'm very grateful to have today. And I say that because my dad passed away about 2 weeks ago. So I've been spending a lot of time processing through that, thinking about the past, things like that.
My condolences for that.
No, and I appreciate that, Wade. I do. As far as my story goes, I say I'm from Eastern Kentucky because people need to understand that there are parts in the United States, there are places where that if you're not fortunate enough to have a job, you may be involved in some sort of scam, hustle, fraud, whatever you want to call it. My mom was basically the captain of the entire fraud industry there. This is a woman who at one point, she steals a 108,000-pound Caterpillar D9 bulldozer, tramming it down the road. At another point, she takes a slip and fall in a convenience store, tries to sue the owner. We had a neighbor she acted as a pimp for. That's my mom. And my dad, I mean, bless his, I'll use that Southern phrase, bless his heart.
Yeah.
You know, bless his heart. He was, my dad was just a man. You know, he did good things and bad things. He was the only adult there other than my mom. And he didn't stop the abuse that my mom was intent on delivering to me, my sister, and him. You know, he just put up with it. I don't know if it was because he didn't want to get involved. Maybe he just didn't know what the hell to do. You know, he came from a very good family. But, and I spent a lot of time thinking about that, man, of why my dad didn't stop my mom from doing every fucking thing that she did. To him, she would bring men home in front of him. He would sit there and cry and beg her not to do it. She'd do it anyway. Me and Denise, I mean, she could be physical. And she was until one day Denise, I guess Denise was probably 11, and Denise kicked her through a closet and told her, "Hey, you're not touching us again." And that was the last time Mom beat us right there. But Mom's heart was not in the.
That's your sister, Denise.
It was. Okay. Denise is a year younger. I'm 53. Denise is 52.
Okay.
But that's when the physical abuse stopped. But the bad thing was the mental, the emotional, the verbal. This is a woman who. You know, she, as we were growing up, she would tell us that, you know, she gave up her life for us, that she was going to leave at some point and not come back, that we'd find her dead in a ditch someplace. She would disappear for days at a time, go out partying with friends and men and everything else. And sometimes she'd take me and Denise with her, and, you know, she'd leave us in the car. Sometimes we'd wait in the living room as she partied in the bedroom. Most of the time, she just left me and Denise at home. And for those who don't know who I am, the Secret Service, as I mentioned earlier, they called me the original Internet Godfather. And the way I got that title was 39 felonies, because 38 wasn't enough. So 39 of them. I was placed on the United States Most Wanted list. I had an escape from prison. And if that weren't enough, I built and ran the first organized cybercrime community. It was called Shadow Crew. It was a precursor of today's darknet. Darknet markets laid the foundation for the way modern cybercrime channels operate today. So that's why I'm called. You ask if I was that OG, and I am absolutely responsible for the trust mechanism that's still being used in cybercrime channels today. So yeah, I'm that son of a bitch that did that. And my life of crime begins back when I was 10 years old. My mom had left my dad. She moved us from Panama City, Florida, back to Hazard, Kentucky. She, as I said, she used to disappear for days at a time. And, you know, I'm the kid that I post up at the window looking to see if Mom's coming home. Sometimes I'll walk out into the driveway, see if she's driving down the street. Denise is the kid who's just angry all the damn time. So Mom had been gone for a few days. We didn't have any food in the house. Denise walks in, she's got this pack of pork chops in her hand, and I'm like, "Where'd you get that?" And she's like, "I stole it." And I was like, "Show me how you did that." And she takes me over, shows me how she's stealing food, and I'm like, "Best idea ever." So we start shoplifting food, and we get to where I was 10. Denise was 9. We get to where we're wanting a sandwich, and what we were doing is we were stuffing the food down our pants, right? Well, you can't stuff a loaf of bread down your pants. So I looked at my sister, I was like, "Let me see what I can do." Famous last words for any cyber criminal out there: "Let me see what I can do." There was a Kmart across the way. Walked in, got one of those zip-up hoodies off the rack, took the tags off of it, put it on, wore it out, got outside with it. And the way you steal bread when you're 10 years old is you take that loaf of bread and you stuff it down the sleeve of the hoodie, throw the hoodie over top, across your shoulder, and walk outside. And needless to say, Kmart's got a lot more stuff than, you know, hoodies.
Right.
So it becomes, you know, we start stealing clothes and jewelry and toys and books and music and all that bullshit. My mom comes home, sees all the stolen stuff, sees the Atari 2600 and the Intellivision that I'm playing. Where'd that come from? And I'm like, "Well, we found it." She's like, "No, you didn't find that." And my sister stands up, "We stole it." And my mom looks at my sister and, "Show me how you did that." And then she calls her mom to join in as well. And her mom, the funny thing, her mom's name was Alverna Campbell. And Alverna was like I think she was like a third grade teacher, elementary school teacher. And this is a woman who absolutely joined in with that stuff as well. I mean, it was that's where my life of crime begins. That's just beginning. And for your listeners out there, here's the thing. I don't really care what kind of childhood you've got. My childhood had nothing. The way I was raised had nothing to do with my choices as an adult.
Right.
You know, when I became an adult, I had the opportunity to choose not to break the law. And I didn't choose that. I chose to keep right on trucking. You know, my sister, other than that shoplifting experience, she doesn't break the law again. She goes off to be a teacher, a parent, just a good citizen. Me, I'm the kid that kept on going. And as I kept on going, I found out that not only mommy, but every single person on that side of the family was involved in some sort of scam, hustle, or fraud. So I grew up, man. I grew up knowing how to do document fraud, insurance fraud, so burning homes for cash, faking stolen cars, faking accidents, charity fraud, illegally strip mining coal. I mean, you name it, I had a background in it until I finally branched off on my own. I was in the, I got married to my first wife, I think, 94. Faked a car accident to get the money to get married. Moved from Hazard, Kentucky to Lexington, Kentucky to go to UK. So, yeah, I'm a wildcat. And the thing is I get the worst parts from my mom and my dad. My mom, of course, I get that criminal mindset. Oh, yeah. But my dad, he was the guy that I view him as scared of the people that he loved leaving. Mm-hmm. That's the way I'd always perceived him like that. So I get that from him. I'm always scared that, you know, the people I care about is going to leave. So I'm the son of a bitch that buys love. And I'm not talking about strippers or escorts. I'm guilty of that shit too. But I'm talking about, you know, the people that I cared about. It was always, you know, my love is worth this expensive crap. So my first wife, I didn't have a lot of money. But what I did was I was like, hey, don't worry about working. I got this. No, don't worry about the cooking and the cleaning. You just worry about going to school. I got it all. Well, no, I didn't have it all. 60-hour week job, 18-hour class load, all the cooking, all the cleaning. Nah, something had to give. And what gave was the job. And with that proclivity toward fraud, well, you got to eat. And I was doing these little scams around Lexington, Kentucky. Set up my own charity, got caught doing that, spent 3 months in county jail, got out, and found eBay. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you knew this or not, but eBay used to be, it started out as a Pez sales sites. So, you know, the little Pez dispensers?
Yeah.
Started out selling those, and then it morphs into this auction site. Well, I found eBay right as it was morphing into that auction site. And I was like, shit, this is fantastic. Got to be some way to make money on this. Didn't know how. And back then, Bill O'Reilly, that Fox News host that got his ass in trouble for the sexual harassment, mm-hmm. he used to host Inside Edition. Inside Edition is this 30-minute TV news tabloid show back then. And they were profiling Beanie Babies that night. And for those who don't remember, Beanie Babies were this high-dollar collectible, these little stuffed animals, and they were going for buku amounts of dollars back then. Mm-hmm. The one they were profiling was called Peanut Royal Blue Elephant, selling for $1,500 on eBay. And I'm sitting there watching like, shit, I need to find me a peanut. So skip class the next day. Here I am. I was naive as hell, man. I was thinking, well, there's got to be one in a bin someplace. I'm in Kentucky. So I go around all the Hallmark stores looking for this damn thing. Takes me about 3 hours to figure out, no, idiot, he's not in the Hallmark stores. His ass is on eBay for $1,500. But they did have these little gray Beanie Baby elephants for $8. So what I did was, you buy the gray Beanie Baby elephant for $8, stop by Kroger on the way home, pick up a pack of blue Rit dye, go home, try to dye the little guy. Turns out they're made out of polyester. They don't hold dye very well. You get them out of the bath, they look like they've got the mange. But here's the thing, dude. I mean, the truth of the matter, I ripped a lady off of $1,500. Found a picture of a real one online, posted it. This lady thought I had the real thing. She wins the bid. Soon as she wins the bid, this thing called social engineering kicks in. See, when I was a child, I had to know what the adults in my circle were doing immediately and know how to manipulate that. So that's called social engineering. All right. When I became an adult, I used those tools to victimize other people. So this woman wins this bid for this creature. I don't want to be on the defensive of that conversation. I want her on the defensive. So I sent her a message. Hey, you win the bid. Congratulations. By the way, we've never done any business before. I don't even know if I can trust you. What I need you to do is go down to the U.S. Postal Service, pick up a couple of money orders totaling $1,500. It's issued by the U.S. government. It protects you. It protects me. You send me those money orders, I'll send you your animal. Well, she believed that, and she sends me the money orders. I cash them out, send her the creature, immediately get this call. This is not what I ordered. My response was, lady, you ordered a blue elephant. I sent you a blue-ish elephant. And right there is the first lesson of cybercrime. And that lesson is, if you delay a victim long enough, you just keep putting them off. A lot of them, they get exasperated. They throw their hands in the air. They walk away. You don't hear from them again. And none of them complain to law enforcement. So that's the first lesson of cybercrime. And that's still the first lesson that people or criminals learn today. It's still, whether you're a company or an individual, that still holds true today. First crime I committed online. Got away with it, did it under my own name, very unsophisticated, but I kept going and got to where I was getting better at understanding the dynamics of online crime. So I got to where I was selling pirated software. Pirated software, back then it was for PlayStation 1, Sega Saturn, and then Dreamcast from there. But you had to install a mod chip on the circuit board in order to play the pirated games, right? So I started soldering I had had a job at Lexmark of all places, testing printer boards and soldering things in place. So I knew how to do that shit. So I started doing mod chips. Mod chips led into putting mod chips into cable television boxes so you could watch all the channels.
Oh, yeah.
And then finally, that led into programming satellite DSS cards, those 18-inch RCA systems. Mm-hmm. Take the access card out of it, program it, turn on all the channels. Started doing that at almost the exact same time a Canadian judge ruled that it was legal for Canadian citizens to pirate those signals. He actually said it in court. He was like, hey, since RCA doesn't sell the systems, it's legal to pirate it. So what happens is almost overnight, United States, you go down to Best Buy, buy the system for $100, take it out in the parking lot, open it up, pull the system out, pull the card out, throw the system away, program the card, ship it to Canada, $500 a pop. Started doing that, making a lot of money, had so many orders I could not fill them all, and thought to myself, I was like, why do I need to fill any of the orders? They're in Canada. I'm down here. Who are they going to complain to? It's illegal. So I didn't fill any of the orders, stole even more money, got worried about how much was coming in. I thought it was going to be looked at for money laundering. Figured the best thing I could do is get a fake driver's license, use that to open up a bank account, launder the money through the account, pull the funds out of an ATM, be good to go. Had no idea where to get a fake driver's license. So I got online, started looking around, thought I found a guy, sent him $200, sent him my picture. Dude rips me off. And oh yeah. And I'm still pissed today because, you know, it ain't no fun being a victim.
Yeah.
Back then I was so angry that the result was Shadow Crew. So if you look at, and this is the really interesting thing. So cybercrime, it's never a single criminal that seeks to victimize you or your organization. It's always a group of individuals. And there's a reason for that. If you think about online crime, in order for it to succeed, three things have to take place. You have to gather data, you have to commit a crime, and then you have to be able to cash that crime out. The problem is that a single attacker, I won't call them criminals because they're not all criminals, they're not all looking just for cash, but a single attacker cannot do all three things. He can do one, sometimes two, rarely all three. So he has to network with other people who are good in those areas where he is not. Mm-hmm. Now, before Shadow Crew comes into play, the only avenue you had to do that was IRC, Internet Relay Chat, this rolling chat board where you had no idea who the hell you were talking to, if you could trust them, believe them, if they had a product or service, if they had it, if it worked, or if they were just going to rip you off because every single person there was a criminal. So Shadow Crew solves that. There's actually three sites. There's Counterfeit Library, Shadow Crew, and then Carter Planet. That sets the tone, and it's the genesis of all modern cybercrime as we know it today. I built and ran both Counterfeit Library and Shadow Crew. A Ukrainian national by the name of Dmitry Golubov, he sees the success that we're having with Counterfeit Library. He was a spammer, and he has this idea. He was getting all these credit card details, and he was like, I wonder if people would buy stolen credit card details. Turns out they will. So he literally picks up the phone. He calls his buddies. They call their buddies. They have a physical conference in Odessa. 150 of these criminals show up, and they launch Carter Planet, which is the genesis of all modern credit card theft as we know it. So what happens is, with Shadow Crew expressly, we come up with this thing that I refer to as the trust mechanism. Because with just IRC, there's no way to trust other criminals in an online environment. Mm-hmm. Shadow Crew kind of solidified trust, what that should look like. And the way it looks, what it looks like online is you've got a large communication channel, a forum type structure, where individuals from different time zones can reference conversations days, weeks, months old. They can take part in those conversations, ask questions, learn from those conversations. You knew by looking at someone's screen name what the skill level of that person was, what the history of that individual was. We had vouching systems in place, review systems in place, escrow systems in place, all with the singular purpose of establishing trust with one criminal and another when they would never meet, not know each other's real names, and not even know what each other looked like. So that's primarily what Shadow Crew accomplished. It was also the first site of its type that sold any type of criminal goods and services. So think of it as the eBay of criminal marketplaces, like the dark web marketplaces today.
Now, had you moved on from the cable boxes and stuff at this point?
Oh, yeah. I had long given that up.
Okay. Well, I knew that was a big thing. I mean, I had one of those growing up. My dad knew a guy that would get, they were just the descrambler boxes. And then later on after that, you had the cable box where you could do the cards, and you have to pay guys to do the cards. And then they had that free to air thing out of Canada, which may be what you're referring to. I'm not sure if that's the same thing.
So what happened with us is we started out, you would be able to, so the descramblers on cable systems in Kentucky it started out as a metal tube. I don't know if you've ever seen those things or not. Those would be on the line.
Screw into the back.
You could take the damn tubes and steal them. So we started doing that. Then they came out with the cable boxes themselves at that point, and you'd have to take the box apart. The actual where you would put the mod chip, they had epoxy and all this bullshit over top of it. You'd have to take your little Dremel tool and ground it down enough so you could get to it, put the mod chip in there, and then it would turn on all the channels. Okay, so that's basically what we did there. And I was doing cable like that for everybody. At our apartment building, there was one guy who paid for cable, and I'll be damned if I hadn't tied everybody else on that entire apartment building to his thing at his reception. Everybody else was coming through bright and clear. His TV looked like absolute shit, and he was not happy about that at all. The cable company would come, they'd fix it, they'd find all the wires and all that bullshit, they'd cut them all loose. I'd be back up in the ceiling that night, putting everything together. The cable company come back, they put locks on the boxes, everything else. I'd get out there and bolt cutters and cut them off and all that. Yeah, I was horrible, man. And then what happens is with the DSS, with RCA, I mean, I was already doing the cards. So back then you had the F card. I think it was, the F card was the big one back then.
Yeah.
And that was very easy to program. Now, you couldn't do Dish Network that way because that was much more complicated. It had this cycling key that you had to have a little box attached to it that it would cycle with you on that. But for RCA systems, it was easy enough to do that until they started looping the damn card. So it would actually burn the circuit, the chip on the card. It would actually burn some of the circuits on that. So you couldn't use the card anymore at that point. So that became a lot of problems. But I got out of all that, went into credit card stuff. I was doing eBay scams. I mean, I was horrible, man. I was a straight piece of shit. Excuse my language, but I was. I mean, there was no redeeming feature whatsoever. Now that's the truth. I stole from. I lied to everybody. My joke. People would ask what I did for a living, and I would tell them that I was a fraud consultant. I just wouldn't tell them on which side of the fraud equation that I was. So yeah. Yeah, that was, I mean, I told everybody that, and I would just hee hee ha ha when I said it. And, but I lied to everybody. I stole from everybody, from friends, family members, people that I didn't know. I mean, it was, completely despicable. I deserved every single minute of prison time that I got. Absolutely.
Wow. So you're meeting together, you're putting together, and it sounds like it's crazy that they have a whole conference where all these people meet. Yeah. You get all that going. Does it just kind of pick up and snowball from there?
It was. So you got to figure that. And today you see that going on. It's much more popular. But back then, there was no site of its type. We were the first to ever try anything like that. And it really was this field of dreams for criminals. If you build it, they will come. And that's exactly what happened because, you know, everyone was looking. Not everyone, but you had a significant population that was looking on how to profit through fraud and scams and criminal activity online, from drug trafficking to credit cards, what have you. And because of IRC, there was no real way to trust those other individuals, to network with them, to buy products or services. And you're seeing that now on Telegram. So Telegram is the Wild West today of cybercrime. Mm-hmm. And the problem with Telegram is that about 70% of everything that's advertised is not real. It's simply criminals that are ripping off other criminals. And the reason that's happening is that Telegram has not established how to build trust or establish trust with each other yet. It's well established on the traditional dark web, but it's not on Telegram. So until they figure that out, and I'm sure they will at some point, but right now it's just, you know, big dog eat little dog is the only thing it is over there. Now, that's not to say you can't get criminal goods and services that will allow you to profit. You absolutely can. Mm-hmm. But more than not, you're going to get ripped off on Telegram. Okay. So yeah, so Shadow Crew was that field of dreams for criminal activity. Now, Script comes along, Dmitry Golubov, they build Carter Planet, and that's the genesis of all modern credit card theft as we know it. So back then with Counterfeit Library, we were doing just eBay scams. Typically, you'd list an item, you know, a camera, laptop, something like that, that you didn't have. And then you'd proceed to sell that laptop or camera to the top 10 highest bidders on eBay is what would happen. And you'd profit an eBay account, brand new account. You'd usually profit about $12,000 off each new account that you set up from stolen goods, you know, from stolen money. Golubov comes in and he advertises. He says, hey, we've got credit card details. And we can change the credit card billing information to whatever address you want to whatever phone number you want to. And then you can max out the card at that point, ordering products. That when I reviewed that, because I was the head of this environment at that point in time, when I reviewed that, we switched. At that point in time, it was Counterfeit Library. Counterfeit Library morphs from an eBay and PayPal fraud site to a credit fraud site within probably 24, 36 hours. And a lot of money gets stolen at that point in time. You figure you've got, back then we ended with 4,000 members. So you've got 4,000 members across the planet that are using stolen credit card details to pocket as much money as they possibly can. So it was pretty effective. We made the front cover of Forbes, August of 2004. Headline, Who's Stealing Your Money? Or Who's Stealing Your Identity? October 26, 2004, United States Secret Service arrested 33 people, 6 countries, 6 hours. I'm the only guy that publicly was mentioned as getting away. There were a couple of others that got away as well. They pick me up February 8, 2005, and they give me a job. And I'm the idiot that continues to break the law from inside Secret Service offices for the next 10 months until they find out about it. I take off on a cross-country crime spree, steal $600,000 in 4 months, wake up one morning in Las Vegas on the United States Most Wanted list, say to myself, what are you going to do now, Brett? Go to Disney World. Go to Disney World, get arrested, sent to prison, escape prison, get arrested again, serve out my time. That's this idiot right here. Yeah.
And I heard you tell that story about you're in prison and you're doing work, supposedly trying to help them, and they're not really paying attention. So you just start doing crime again right there using their own damn computer.
Yeah, I was in Secret Service, so the way that the way it was set up, they arrested me February 8th, 2005, passing counterfeit cashier's checks. Within 30, 45 minutes, Secret Service comes in. They take over the investigation. All right. They let me sit in a county jail for 3 months to get my ass out. I go to work 30 days later. That was in Charleston, South Carolina. I move up to Columbia, South Carolina, 30 days later, because that's where the Secret Service field office is in Columbia.
Yeah.
So move up there, and they had me in basically their war room, which was large-ass room. They had me on a laptop hooked up to a 50-inch plasma monitor mounted on the wall, outside internet line. Next to me, they had a desktop computer, two Secret Service agents in the room at all times, one SLED officer, so South Carolina Law Enforcement Division.
I'm aware.
So there were three law enforcement officers in the room at all times, all right? On my laptop, everything was recorded with Spectre Pro and Camtasia. So you had keystrokes being recorded, and you had snapshots of the screen every 15 seconds that were being recorded. All right. So the first, 2 weeks, I go in there 4 to 6 hours a night, and my job is to surf the web, to find targets, to milk those targets out, get information, set up potential investigations for arrest later on. So the first, 2 weeks, hell, they're diligent as hell. They're asking questions. They're sitting there going, what about this? What about this? What about this? Well, when I'm doing this thing, I am extremely fast. So I'll have, 15, 20 different windows open, just cycling between every single one of them, having multiple conversations, everything else. And it gets pretty boring. And they got bored after about 2 weeks. So what happens is they start going to this site called flashyourrack.com, which, I mean, so if, for those who don't know, it may still even be up. I don't know. But back then, it was simply snapshots of women and their breastises, and you would rank them on a scale of 1 to 10. So
that's a civic duty there, by God.
That's it. So they would spend, 4 hours on Flash Your Rack every night. So I'm sitting there, I'm sitting there watching it, and I'm like, shit, I'm going to prison anyway. Why not? And I realized, they were recording everything, but everything every night went on a DVD. So they weren't cataloging it at all. So, and they were never going to go through that much data. So I'm sitting there going, hell, why not? I'm going to go to prison anyway. So I start breaking the law inside of Secret Service offices with them in the room with me. Not the brightest in the world. So it takes them 10 months to find out. And they are not happy at the end of 10 months, needless to say.
How did you wind up getting arrested for that first? Was it just a roundup, or did you get caught up in something? How did you wind up getting arrested that first time? And was that in Charleston?
That was in Charleston. So that's a very good question.
What area were you in Charleston, just out of curiosity?
I had a home over on Folly Beach, Oak Island.
Okay. So I'm in Somerville, so not okay. Very far.
I love Somerville. I did theater in Somerville.
Okay. Yeah,
I love Somerville, man. But what happens is I'm from Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And as I became better at crime, I migrated south until finally I hit Charleston, South Carolina. So I was married at the time. My first wife, Susan, we were married for 9 years. And I lied to her every single day. It took her 3 years to find out I was a criminal. After she found out I was a criminal, the next 6 years were me saying, I've stopped, I will stop, I'm going to stop just a little while longer. And then finally it became, you like spending the money, don't you? So she figured out, hey, this son of a bitch isn't about to stop. So she leaves me. And that fear that I talked about just a few minutes ago of, you know, people that I love leaving, that became real. Yeah, it was my fault. That doesn't make it any less real. So I was in Charleston, and Susan had left me. So I go through this, you know, deep, dark depression, realize I'm getting suicidal, figure I needed to do something about that. And so I picked up the phone book, hit the yellow pages, hit psychology, hit criminal psychology, because, you know, why the hell not? Called this psychologist crying and told her everything. And she's like, come in now. So I went in, and hell, I told her everything, man, what I did for a living, all that stuff. And saw her for about 4 months. She was, I forgot what her name was, but she was trying to get me to stop breaking the law and to go into real estate. And I kept saying, is there a difference? You know, but what happens is one night, hell, I was 35 at that point. 35? No, I was 34. I didn't start drinking until I was 34. I was always the clean cut criminal. And so one night, you know, I saw that psychologist for about 4 months. One night I got lonely. I got horny. I had never been into a strip club before. And I was like, tonight's the night. And I am that dude. I am literally that dude that falls in love with the first one that he sees. I walk in, she walks by. I'm like, that one is the one for me. Yeah. So I moved her in with me. After I moved her in with me, found out she is addicted to cocaine. Of course she was. Not only was she addicted to cocaine, but she was prostituting herself to support her habit.
And now, she told you that, or you found it out?
No, dude, I found out. I was, you know, the thing is I was naive as shit. I was, she was dancing, and, you know, she'd work the weekends. And what would happen was, is, you know, she wouldn't come home. So, you know, she would call me typically, I can't drive home, come and get me. And she'd be in a parking lot someplace. So my dumb ass would go and get her, bring her back. And about the second time that happened, I was like, shit, something's going on. I had never been through a woman's purse in my entire life. So my dumb ass, she goes in there and passes out. And I'm like, let's see what the hell is going on here. Go through her purse and find the, you know, the half straws, find the Coke and all that stuff. And it breaks my heart, man, because the truth of the matter was, is I loved the shit out of that woman. I did. I was crazy over her. And I confronted her with it. And she was like, oh, it's not like that. I just do it every now and then. And I was like, uh-huh. And she told me she had quit. She does it again the next weekend. I bring her back home and I leave her a note. And I'm like, I'm going to Columbia for the day. So I leave her a note. I'm like, hey, if you don't quit, don't be here when I get back. And by God, that night she quit her job because, let's be honest, I had a shitload of money.
Yeah.
She quit her job. She gave up drugs, but she supplemented it with alcohol. And at the same time, she wouldn't leave my side. So I had to be there all the time. Well, the thing about cybercrime, especially if you're doing credit theft or something like that, and I was doing credit theft and I was doing, I'd came up with this thing called tax return identity theft. So the reason your all's tax returns are delayed every single year is this SOB right here. I'm the guy that invented that crap. All right. But when you're doing that, you can't keep it local. It's that whole process of don't shit where you eat. Because she had to have me around all the time, I couldn't take these road trips to do anything. So I start going through all of my savings. I had most of my money overseas in Latvia, Estonia. So I had most of my money overseas. I had a bankroll in the United States. Went through all of that. As I go through all of that, that's when Shadow Crew makes the front cover of Forbes. Not only that, but that's when Shadow Crew gets busted by the Secret Service. So I all of a sudden, I don't have any money. Tax season's over. I can't go into credit theft because I don't know who to trust anymore because they've disrupted everything all of a sudden. So I go into the one thing that I had taught people never to do, checks. And I do checks local. So I get picked up by the FBI and the Charleston PD. And within 45 minutes is when Secret Service comes in, takes over the investigation. Now, I also get picked up 3 weeks before I was supposed to get married to this girl. You know, I was that dumbass. Yeah, let's call it what it is. I was that dumbass too. Now, the truth of the matter is, Wade, I mean, looking back at it now, all right, and I have talked to this woman over the past year, all right, just to apologize to her for everything that my dumbass did, because I was not a good guy. But, you know, we were not suited for each other. I think that we both loved each other, but we were absolutely not suited for each other at all.
Right.
But that was just what happened, man. And
she's so, still yeah, here? I go to work.
Yeah, she's in Charleston.
Oh, okay.
Sure is. Yeah, she's still there.
Wow. And what club was it that you met her at?
Joe's Roundup. You remember that one?
Sproul Avenue.
That's the one. For those who don't know, So you had back then, I don't know how many clubs are in Charleston now, but you had an all-nude one.
Mm-hmm. That's right Southern Bell.
That's it. So you have the all-nude one. Then down the street, you had this thing called Joe's Roundup, which literally the stage was big enough for one girl at a time. Two girls worked that place at one time is what happened. The private dance area was at the front of the club. All right. So, and they didn't sell alcohol. They sold beer only. So my dumbass, when I go in there and meet her, you know, I'm buying these drinks for her for $25 because this is my first rodeo. I didn't know. Then she's like, do you want a bottle of champagne? And I'm like, well, how much is a bottle of champagne? $400 for a bottle of Korbel. And I'm like, shit, that's $7.50 at the grocery store. So that's what my dumbass does. And then across from Joe's Roundup, you had basically the brothel, a little massage parlor where you'd go in and get your rocks off if you wanted to. And you could pick the woman and everything else. So that was that area. And I'm not sure how it's changed over the years. Hell, this was back in, you know, the early 2000s before they put the bridge in.
Things change, but they stay the same. I'll put it like
that. Of course they do, you know. But, yeah, that was the downfall there. And, I mean, there's a whole story on that stuff.
When you're doing the tax returns, how are you pulling that off? Because I found that quite interesting.
So what happens is back then, identity theft, you could go to sites. There were certain databases that you could access that had DOB, had social security number, mother's maiden, things like that. And back then, organizations didn't understand the importance of PII. So the first database that I got access to was the Indiana State Sex Offenders Registry. All right. And so back then, that registry, so if you were a pedophile, your name would be online. Your social security number would be there, your driver's license, your date of birth, your mother's maiden. It would have your complete identity profile there. All right. So I found that and I thought to myself, well, shit, nobody's going to care if I take advantage of a bunch of pedophiles. Everybody wants to take advantage of their dumbasses. So I started opening up bank accounts in their name and I would sell these bank accounts to other members of Shadow Crew as well. And that's the first time you saw that type of business online at that point in time. All right. And it helped people launder money, run eBay accounts, things like that. So got to the point that hit so many of them that Indiana started to remove the social security numbers. So you had to find other things. And we got access to the Texas DL database from that point. And then on down the line, we found the California State Death Index. All right. And my initial question was, and just to backtrack a little bit. So state databases do not, to this day, they do not communicate with federal databases. So you can be, the state itself can know you're dead and the feds never will. Okay. Prior to 1998, the only way that the feds knew that you were dead was if the family filled out a Social Security death benefit. It took the family to do that. After 1998, the hospital would do it or the mortuary would do that. Okay. So the only way that the feds know if someone's dead, that if they died prior to 1998, was the Social Security death benefit. And most people never filled that out because, hey, you only get $200 and hey, we're in mourning and hey, we don't know about this shit to begin with. So my question was, my initial question was, I wonder if you can fill out Social Security benefits for these individuals. So someone that died, you know, at 45, 50 years old, and they would be 65 now, could I get their Social Security payments? Would the government allow that? Well, it turns out they won't. The number's been dormant for so long that they want you to come in for a sit-down interview, and that's not going to work.
Yes.
So the next question I had was, well, I wonder if you could file tax refunds or returns on dead people. Turns out you can, all right? And you can very successfully do that. So I started to do that, and I got to where I was able to file one return every 6 minutes manually, all right? So I would typically file somewhere between 100 to 140 returns a week.
I'd
do nothing but file returns Sunday through Wednesday, all right? Thursday, I would take a road trip, plot out a map of ATMs. Friday and Saturday, I would cash out prepaid debit cards that those tax returns were deposited on. Typically, on a weekly basis, I would pull in anywhere from $100,000 to $160,000 a week. It would go into a backpack, all these $20 bills. I would come home to my house at Folly Beach. I had a spare bedroom. I would open up the door, chuck the backpack in. Then one day, you open up the door, and you're like, shit, I got to do something with all these backpacks. That's when you start learning how to launder money, and that's how most of it ends up over in Estonia. So that's what happened.
So are you limited to how much you can take out per car, per ATM? That's why you got to map out this long progress, because you can only get so much?
The problem is you're pulling, so you've got a stack of prepaid debit cards. So you may have, you know, 60, 80 of these cards. How long does it take to pull the money out of the ATM? Well, you're only getting 20s out, all right? So that's a lot of the problem right there. At the same time, an ATM may only have 15,000, 18,000, 24,000 in it. So if you're 40 minutes at an ATM, how many cops are you going to see in that 40-minute span? The first time you see one is when you need to move your ass to the next ATM, because if that cop swings by again and still sees your dumb ass at an ATM, he's going to think something. So you need to have a map of these ATMs plotted out, you know, and that's all trial and error is what that is. You know, when you first start, you're like, got your stack of cards, you go out an ATM and you're like, shit, this is taking forever. Then you start to feel paranoid. I wonder how many people are, you know, questioning me. You know, this guy's been here a while.
It's a 4-digit PIN, man.
Exactly. So you plot a map out, you know, 10, 15, 20 ATMs, and you need that map plotted out, because the worst thing is you go from one ATM and then all of a sudden you're trying to figure out where another ATM is. Mm-hmm. So you plot out a map of ATMs and go like that. All right. And I would cash cards out Friday, Saturday, and then come back home, start back over again, and do that typically 10 months out of the year.
And this is the money that you ran through during the time before you got arrested?
So what happens is, you know, I've got most of those funds laundered overseas. I've got a nest egg of cash, and I had a nice nest egg of cash, you know, a few $100,000. But I was the guy, prior to meeting Elizabeth, I was very circumspect and low key with my money. I had a house, yes, but it was not a really fancy house. I drove, I had a Mini Cooper. I had a truck. I mean, nothing really expensive. I had a boat and all that stuff, but I didn't show money off. I didn't go out and eat $300 dinners every night. I didn't party like that. I was very low key. When I met Elizabeth, that changed dramatically. There was no longer eating at the house in Applebee's. There was eating at the Charleston Grill and shit like that every single night. You know, there was parties every weekend. There was, you know, $1,000 shoes. There was $2,000-$3,000 purses every weekend. Shit like that went on. And
I heard you talk about a restaurant that's still open, that Rue de Gero or something like that.
Oh, is it still down there?
It's still there. Yeah,
man, you go in there So the sushi's off the rocks. I mean, it's outstanding. You got the sushi, you got that fruit, you know, the fruits of the sea platter as an appetizer. You start out with that, you'd get two bottles of champagne and not Corbel either.
So you bring me your best Corbel right now.
Exactly. I'll take the top of the line Corbel. Let's get the rosé tonight. So you get that shit. And when you're spending money like that, it goes pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm from Kentucky, dude. So this chick, it starts out, I move her in with me and it starts out, well, I need a flat iron. And I was like, what the hell is that? Well, it's like a curling iron, except it's flat so I can straighten my hair. And I was like, well, shit, we can go to Target and get you that. She's like, no, not Target. I'm like, okay. So we go down. I forgot what the name of the damn thing was. It's a chain of these high class salons. It's through Charles. There's like five or six of them back there.
Like Paul Mitchell or something like that.
It wasn't Paul. It was some crap. They sold all this other high dollar crap, you know. Yeah. And so she goes and gets this flat iron that's like $200. And I'm freaking out. I'm like, shit, Target's got that son of a bitch for 10. You know? So that was the first thing. Then the second thing was, and I wore Tommy Bahama and like Lucky jeans and shit like that. So she tells me, she's like, I need to pick up some blue jeans. And I'm like, okay, where do you want to go? And she's like, back then Saks was in Charleston before they closed. And Saks Fifth Avenue. Well, I didn't shop at Saks Fifth Avenue. So I'm like, okay, let's go. So we walk into Saks and I'm walking over to the men's outfit, you know, shirts and all that. And I'm seeing, you know, $200 a shirt. And I'm like, meanwhile, I happen to glance across the way where she is at the jeans counter and she's just packing the jeans. Bam, 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 bam. I walk over and they're seven for all mankind, you know, $180 a pair. And I'm sitting there going, holy shit. You know? Yeah. If you got money and somebody will find a way to spend it for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guarantee it.
So, yeah.
All right. So I wanted to get a little background on that. So you go, you do get arrested. You're doing the stuff with them.
Yeah.
After that, do you get transferred to actually do a little time? Because I know I wanted to definitely get to that story where you did escape, because that story was hilarious.
Yeah. So what happens is you know, I screw over the Secret Service, commit the crime from inside the offices, take off on this crime spree, go to Disney World, get arrested, and they tracked me using back then they called it trigger fish. Today they call it Stingray. So it's this box that simulates a cell phone tower where they can locate a phone within 7 feet. All right. So they find me using a trigger fish. And what happens was I had rented a timeshare in Orlando and paid for 9 months cash. All right. And at the same time, I bought $30,000 worth of furniture to go in it and a $30,000 DVD collection, because they had seized the first one. I go back and buy it again and they seize it too. So that's dumbass right here. So buy this thing. And it was September 16th of 2006, September 16th of 2006. I was at that timeshare and I was asleep, and about 10 o'clock in the morning, I hear this knock on the door. And I was used to, because they were still building the complex, I was used to builders coming by and asking if everything was okay. So I get my dumb ass up, look out the peephole, nobody's there. Open up the door, step out in the hallway, and walking down the hall is a Orange County deputy and then two South Carolina Secret Service agents. And they turn around and they're like, hi, Brett. And I'm like, hi, guys. And they're like, how are you doing? And I'm like, I'm doing good. Would you guys like to come in? And Bobby Kirby, he looks at me. He's like, yes, let's put you in cuffs first. And I'm like, probably a good idea. So I walk in. They sit me down on the sofa. I bought this Restoration Hardware sofa. They sit me down on the sofa. Bobby looks at me and he's like, do you have anything here? And I'm like, yeah, there's $150,000 cash in the bedroom. And he's like, oh. So he goes to walk in the bedroom as he's walking in there. And I'm like, plus there's an AK-47 in there. And he stops dead in his tracks. And he's like, are you fucking shitting me? And I'm like, yeah, I'm just kidding. So yeah, that's dummy right here. So I go to They put me in the Orange County jail. That's what they do. And they have a federal holding there. I was very fortunate. So this guy that everyone called Yeti, he was in for meth charges. Of course he was. So he kind of takes me in under his wing. So we're talking one day and he's like, you know, Brett, the only time you get off in federal prison is through the drug program. And I'm like, Yeti, I don't use drugs. And he was like, Brett, you can find a drug problem, can't you? And I'm like, Yeti, I can find a drug problem. So they give me this thing called diesel therapy. And diesel therapy, when they're really pissed off at you, when they're transporting you from, say, Orlando back to Columbia, South Carolina, they stop at every county jail they possibly can along the way. It took me 2 weeks to get from Orlando back to Columbia. And what happens is you go through processing. So for those who have never been in jail before, processing at a county jail is 4, 6, 8 hours long.
Yeah.
And you sit your happy ass there in on a concrete bench until they get through with you. You're dead tired. So they're doing that. As soon as I hit the bunk, next morning, pack your shit. We're moving again. And the idea is to wear you down emotionally and mentally and physically. And it works like a charm. So, yeah. So every county jail that I stop at, they also ask when they're processing you, hey, any drug problems? And I'm like, yep, cocaine, alcohol, and I'm needing help. So by the time I get to Columbia, I've got this paper trail of me saying, hey, I'm on coke. I'm an alcoholic. I really want all the help I can possibly get. My lawyer was Strom Thurmond's son. His name is Paul Thurmond. All right.
Senator Strom Thurmond.
Yep. They made me drop him because I paid for Paul with illegal money. In his place, they gave me a public defender that looked exactly like Billy D. Williams. His name was Jimmy P. Rogers. And I mean, he looked exactly like Billy D. right out of the malt liquor commercial with the Jerry curl, exactly like this. And this guy, he didn't give a shit about nothing. The only good thing he did, he stands up and he gets the judge to order a psychological evaluation for me. That's the only good thing this guy ever did. All right. So psychologist comes into the county jail, 4-hour evaluation. Halfway through, the psychologist is like, do you use any type of drugs? I'm like, yeah, well, what do you use? Cocaine? Smoke or snort? Snort? How much? An 8-ball a day. And he looks at me and he's like, that's a lot. And I'm like, yeah. And he was like, you have any trouble out of that? And I'm like, yeah, I can't get an erection. And he looks at me and I'm looking at him, and I got that from watching the movie Boogie Nights. That end scene where Mark Wahlberg can't stand to attention. Yeah. I'm like, shit, that's got to be real. So I'm looking, we're looking at each other, we're silent. And finally I break the silence and I'm like, is that right? And he's like, it could happen. Is it still happening now? And I'm like, no, not that I needed to work in here. So that makes it into my PSR, pre-sentence report. Pre-sentence report is the probation office and the prosecutor, they do this in-depth background check to see how much time you should get. Mm-hmm. And they recommend the time to the judge. So that drug stuff makes it into my pre-sentence report. So day of sentencing, prosecutor pissed off. He's literally screaming. He's like, Johnson has manipulated the prosecutor. He's manipulated the Secret Service. And today he's manipulating you, Your Honor. We insist on the upper limits of the guidelines. So my guideline range was 60 to 75 months. And I had already told everybody in the pod that if I get any more than 60 months, I am not going to stay. So the judge, she says, I agree, 75 months. I looked at the lawyer and I'm like, can you get me the drug program? Lawyer stands up. Will you order the drug program? Judge is like, no, but I'll recommend he gets evaluated for it. I'm like, look at my lawyer. I'm like, what does that mean? My lawyer's like, you're probably not going to get it. I'm like, how soon can you get me to the camp? And he looks at me and he was like, pretty soon if you don't appeal. And my exact words were, fuck the appeal. Get me to the camp. I'll take it from there. He looks at me like I'm the biggest idiot in the world. We don't appeal. You know, 6 weeks later, I'm at the camp. And I'd had family, because you can have when you're in federal prison, you can get a recommendation. Your family can, or you can request that you're sent to a specific institution.
Right.
So I requested Ashland, Kentucky, because my family had looked it up and it was not supposed to have a fence around it. So get there, 14-foot fence, razor wire on top. And I'm like, I don't climb very well. So I walk in through processing, look at the guard, and I'm like, hey, man, is there any jobs outside of the fence? And he was like, well, yeah, you can work in the National Forest. And I'm like, no, dude, I'll die out there. And then he was like, well, you can do landscaping. And I'm like, I can run a weed eater. So 3-4 days later, I walk into the landscaping office. The guard, he's got his desk, the wall behind his desk, that entire wall is an aerial photo of the compound blown up. So I can literally sit there, talk to him, and plot my escape the entire time. About the same time this is happening, my dad, I hadn't talked to my dad in over 20 years. He shows up at my sentencing, stands up in front of the judge, and he's like, Your Honor, I want to make sure my son gets a good start when he gets out. He can come and live with me. So my dad starts to visit me in Ashland, and about the third visit in, he looks at me. He's like, you know, I've been reading about you online. I'm like, yeah. And he's like, yeah, that's a lot of money you made. I'm like, yeah. And he's like, you think you could teach someone how to do that? And I used to, when I first started saying that, I used to say, you know, I thought my dad had come back in my life and he was just using me. And I kind of thought that for the first few months. And then finally I came to the conclusion that, well, no, my dad remembered me from being a child and he was associating me through that frame of my mom and that criminal activity. And I think that's the way that he thought he had to communicate with me. And I manipulated him into helping me escape. And today, you know, like I said, my dad died a couple weeks ago. I think it's a combination of the two. I do. I think it's me. I think it's he thought, you know, that's the way he had to talk to me. I think he wanted to make some money. And I think I manipulated him at the same time is what I think. And the man helped me escape prison. He had $4,000 to his name. I got that. Got him to bring me a change of clothes, a cell phone, a driver's license. He dropped it at the drop off spot outside of the camp. And I taught him how to do tax return identity theft. In exchange for that. And through my, you know, while I was locked up for that, you know, 7 years, he did tax return fraud that 7 years. Well, he did it for about 4.5 of those 7 years is what he did. And that's what happened, man. So I escape, you know, and I make it about 250 miles away. And I'm waiting for more money to come. I had the, you know, my Ukrainian contacts. They were supposed to send me IDs and more cash, and I was going to bug out. And I didn't know they were being investigated at the same time. So they didn't send shit. Meanwhile, the U.S. Marshals, God bless them, the U.S. Marshals, boy, they are Johnny on the spot. They do a damn fine job locating fugitives. A lot of respect for that. So they canvass a 3-state area. Find my dumbass. I was holed up in a hotel and literally what dummy here, I had dyed my hair flaming red. Now back then, I don't have much hair now, but back then I did. All right. And it was this flaming red mess. I had a deep, dark tan, everything else. So I was at a hotel and I had the curtains open and I guess the marshal already knew which room it was. So this guy walks by the room. He walks by and he stops and he backs up to the window. He knocks on the window, gets my attention. I'm looking at him. He pulls a badge out. He points to the badge. Then he points to the door and says, now. So dummy here, I open up the door. They put me in cuffs, take me to jail. I had a laptop at that point in time. I had prepaid debit cards. I had stolen identities. I was setting up business yet again. And so what happens at my sentencing on the escape, the escape happens so soon after the initial sentencing for the crimes that they use the exact same pre-sentence report. So at the sentencing for that, I pled guilty, of course. Prosecutor stands up and he's like, Your Honor, we would like you to consider that when Mr. Johnson was arrested yet again, that he had a laptop with him, stolen identities, and it looks like he was engaged in business yet again. The judge says no, says, hey, if you were going to consider this, you needed to charge him with it to begin with. I'm only going to consider the escape. And the reason they couldn't do that, the marshals, when they come in, they didn't have a search warrant at all. So they just took this bullshit and they weren't allowed to use it against me. So that was off the block at that point. But judge says, I'm only going to consider the escape. Then he opens up the PSR and he starts going through it. And he's like, Mr. Johnson, it looks like before you got involved with all these drugs that you were a pretty good citizen. And I'm like, yes, Your Honor. And he's like, so what we're going to do is we're going to give you 15 months on the escape. I'm like, yes, Your Honor. And we're also going to order the drug program for you. And I'm like, yes, Your Honor. So what happens is I get 15 months extra for the escape for a total of 90 months in prison. But the drug program gives you 12 months off plus 6 months in a halfway house for 18 months. So by escaping prison, and I don't tell this often, but by escaping prison, I actually saved 3 months off my prison sentence. Now, the bad part about that is I spent 8 months in solitary confinement.
Ooh.
Yeah. And that will get you, man, because I was at Ashland. And when I say solitary, I mean, first few months, you didn't even have a book. You know, it was just you. And then you finally get a King James version of the Bible and you read the shit out of that. And I am well versed in the Bible these days. So, yeah, I can quote verse and chapter these days. So you read the Bible front and back, learn all about baby Jesus. And then finally you start getting some novels in after a while. So I spent 8 months in solitary. Then I'm transferred out and I had no idea where I was going to be transferred. And I was transferred out to West Texas, a place called Big Spring, which is a disciplinary low. Basically it's a medium is what that is. At Big Spring, that's when I find out what a real prison is all about. That it's not guards that run the prison. It's inmates who run the prison. So I walk in, it's a converted Air Force compound. So back in the day, the U.S. Air Force used to train Iranian pilots. Yeah. And this was the compound that did that. So I walk in, they process me through. I go to the barracks because it's all not dorm. It's open barracks is what it is there. So I go to the barracks and I'm met at the door by the treasurer of the Aryan Brotherhood, a guy named Nick Sandifer. And he looks at me, he's like, how many more white guys come in? And I'm like, shit, man, I don't know, four or five. Then he looks at me, he's like, what are you in here for? And I'm like, computer crime. I didn't know when you say computer crime, you're not talking about credit cards and hacking and all that. No, when you say computer crime in prison, you're talking about child pornography.
Right.
So dude looks at me like, ooh, he goes to get all of his big guys to come around. They're like, what'd you say you're in here for? So I'm trying to explain it. They're sitting there going, you know, good story, but well, the thing is, they're not going to do anything until they know for sure that you're a pedophile. And back then they had already gotten rid of, you couldn't travel with your documents anymore because of that stuff. So it took a guard to tell these inmates what was going on. Guards didn't tell them anything. First 30 days though, they think I'm a pedophile. At the end of 30, Wired magazine comes on the compound and I'm in it. So front cover story, you know, about Max Butler. I'm in the story as well. And it's talking about the credit cards, the theft, everything else like that. So I'm like, good, good, good. Then unfortunately, it's got this one line that says Brett Johnson, comma, Secret Service informant. Yeah. So that magazine hit the compound at 4 p.m. We go to chow, and already at chow, there's this little chatter going on. We've got a snitch on the compound. So the next morning, warden locks the entire compound down. Brett Johnson report to the warden's office. So I go in there. They've got all the investigators. They've got the security in there, everything else, counselors, all that. The warden looks at me. He's like, did you give an interview to Wired magazine? And I'm like, yeah, when? And I'm like, well, from Oklahoma on the payphone. And he was like, don't you know they will kill your dumbass here? And I'm like, no. Then he looks at me and he's like, do you feel safe? Well, I knew what that was. If you tell them you don't feel safe, they throw you back in solitary again for 6 to 8 months until they transfer you out. And I had already been seeing shit in solitary. So I was like, oh, I feel completely safe. So they do a locker search, try to confiscate all the magazines. They can't. He tells me, hey, if anyone says anything to you, you had better report it because they will kill you. I'm like, okay. So I go back. Next day, I walk into the unit. Nick Sandifer on his bunk. He's got the damn magazine out reading it. And I'm like, oh, shit. I walked up to him. I was like, hey, Nick, what are you doing? Oh, just doing some reading. Anything interesting? He's like, oh, it's getting that way. And I'm like, let me save you the trouble. Take the magazine, show him the line. And he was like, man, I already knew. And I was like, are we going to have a problem? And he looks at me and he was like, well, is anyone on this compound that you told on? I'm like, no, sir. He's like, until someone gets here that you snitched on, we don't have an issue, but I need you to do something for me. So the do something for me, federal prison, everyone has to have a job. Doesn't matter what you do. You got to have a job. I got a job in education, teaching literature, book club, every Wednesday, 6 to 8 o'clock and 6 to 8:30. Now, did we teach lit? No. Every Aryan signed on to it. Few guards used to attend too. Every Wednesday, 6 to 8:30 p.m., we taught fraud. Let me help you. I'm here for you guys. So I didn't get my ass beat, but I taught everybody every single thing that I knew about fraud. At the same time, my job, weird thing about prison, when someone steps off the prison bus, you get to the point where you can pick out the pedophiles that are walking off that bus. You know them immediately. That guy, that guy, that guy. Most of them are white. All right. So my job was to go to these idiots and basically have this conversation. Hey, I don't know what you're in here for, but if you're in here for anything that's fucked up, you best tell me, because if you start to deal with those guys, they will kill you. And most of the time they would be like, you know, man, I just want to do my time. And you'd know, okay, you're not allowed in the TV room. You may be extorted and you're going to take it. And whatever else might happen to you is going to happen to you at that point in time. So that was my job at Big Spring. I stayed at Big Spring for, I think, 27 months and then transferred over to Fort Worth, where I had the drug program. While at Big Spring, saw two people murdered, went through three prison riots. The murders were interesting because what happens is they were both killed the same way. You had a guy on the track. The inside of the track had two handball courts, and both of them happened on the handball court. One guy would have another guy down and just beat his head into the pavement. And the guards don't come out and stop that because they don't want to get hurt. So, you know, 15 minutes later, after the guy doesn't have a back of his head anymore, the guards come out and get the other guy. Then they lock the compound down from there. 2 days later, you form two lines of inmates and you go into a little room and they ask you two questions. The first question is, did you see anything? And your answer is no. The second question is, if you would have seen anything, would you tell us? And the answer is no. Then they look at you and say, get the fuck out. And you do. Anything longer than that, then you've got your crew that's waiting to say, hey, why were you in there that long? And that happens sometimes. But that's what happened with the murders. Through my incarceration, went through three riots. All of those were race-based riots. They were all Mexican versus or Hispanic versus African-American. Mm-hmm. Saw three or four suicides that I saw.
Because they've got a big stronghold on the prisons down there in Texas, right?
Lyman. They do. Back then, it was for Big Spring, it was the Pisas that ran that compound. So if and they would know if any other gang was coming in. So if it was Serrano, as a guy walked off the bus, Pisa would come up to him and say, hey, you're not allowed on the compound. And most of the time that Serrano would check himself in at that point in time. Every now and then you'd have some idiot that would sit there and say, no, I'm not part of a gang. And the Pisa would say, we know you are. And the guy would be like, no, I'm not. And the guy, Pisa's like, you're sure you're not. And the guy would be like, nope, not a part of a gang member. Come on the compound then. Then that night when lights were off, you'd see this small Hispanic guy with some sort of, you know, toboggan on top of his head, masking his face, with a lock attached to a sock or on a belt. He would run up to this guy that claimed he wasn't a part of a Serrano, and he would just beat the shit out of him with a lock and leave him where he would just crawl to the door, press the buzzer, and then the guards would come and get him and take him out at that point. But yeah, it's that's the way things ran at that point. And I, you know, the trouble that I had after Nick said I didn't have any, you know, any worries, I had one guy that he was an Aryan, and his name was Adam. I forgot what his last name was, but Adam did not accept the higher ups' call to leave me alone. And he would catch me in a crowd or something like that and try to egg it on, you know, talk about me being a snitch and whatnot. So one day I was in the unit with Adam, and we were all around with each other, and Adam's saying something. I'm like, Adam, I want you to know I'm really getting scared of you, man. And Adam's like, well, good, you're supposed to be. And I was like, well, the way this is going to end is I'm going to catch you asleep one night, and I'm just going to stab you in the eye with a pencil. And he looks at me, and I was like, bet. And the next day, Adam checked himself in. His shot caller basically said, no, you got to go. And they sent him out. And that was what happened. But it was Big Spring was interesting, to say the least.
I bet it was. You could fill a whole podcast on probably just that.
Yeah, it was interesting. Now, Fort Worth was outstanding. You had squirrels on the compound. Tame squirrels on the compound. So they would come and sit in your lap that you could walk around with on your shoulder, feed them by hand. They'd come up to the windows on the unit. You could feed them everything else, man. They were outstanding. They were. That was not a bad compound by any stretch of the imagination.
So how long of a stretch was that all total, everything all together?
So all told, I was sentenced to 7.5, served right at 7 total.
Okay.
That's what I served.
Now you get out. What's your plan here?
Well, I get out. My plan is to break the law again. that's my plan. Hard headed, to say the least. I mean, I got out in 2011. My dad met me at so I catch a Greyhound to Tallahassee for the halfway house. My dad meets me at the station. He's got gift cards from tax fraud and cash for me. And I tell him, hey, I'm starting up again. And he's like, no, son, you don't need to do that. And I was like, yep, starting up again. So that was 2011. And what happens is I was not willing to really go into crime again. There were things that I would try, like tax refund fraud. I was more than willing to try that. Fortunately, the IRS in 2011, they started to enact proper security. It took them 8 years to do that. All right. But they started to enact proper security at that point in time. And you could no longer successfully file tax returns on dead people. And I was not wanting to steal living people's identities. So
that was Matt Cox's job.
That was Matt Cox's job. Exactly. not that I'm better than him at all. I'm not. But my dad had a bankroll of cash. So I lived off the funds that he had. My sister helped me out with money as well. Once went through that, I got on food stamps, had a roommate that was taking care of half the rent, and I just did not want to go back and commit any other type of fraud. I was willing, like I said, I was willing to do the tax return stuff. That died. In order to do that, you had to do a lot more crime to be successful at it. I was not willing to do that. Got to the point where I was, I had the money. I mean, getting broke, and I had the money to feed my cat, and didn't have the money to buy toilet paper, and went to the dollar store. I was at Panama City Beach. Had an apartment on Panama City Beach, and went to the dollar store to buy the cat some food. And on the way out, they had a kiosk that was sitting right by the door that had toilet paper there, and ended up shoplifting toilet paper. And about the same time, my wife, Michelle, I met her. Actually, she found me. I didn't find her. So Michelle was the first healthy relationship I've ever had, ever. My sister, I had a healthy relationship with, but Michelle, as far as a romantic relationship, she was the first one I ever that was ever healthy for me. And I ended up moving in with her within 2 months. I guess she knew that my ass was, you know, going to be homeless before long. So I ended up moving her with 2 months. And finally, I got a job. I couldn't get a job, man. I got out. I had job offers from Deloitte, from Know Before, the fishing simulation company, from a couple of payment processors. Couldn't take them because I was not allowed to touch a computer.
Right.
Got to where I was trying to apply for fast food. No, that's a computer. Got to where I ask about waiter's positions and no, that's a computer and credit cards. Idiot. So couldn't get a job, man. And got to the only job I could get was after I moved in with Michelle. We didn't get married, but after I moved in with her, there was a guy that was advertising on Craigslist for landscaping. And I called him up and he was like, come on down and talk to me. I drove from Crestview, Florida down to Destin to talk to him. He was running the business out of his home and sitting there talking to him. About, you know, 30 minutes into the conversation, he looks at me. He's like, can I ask you a question? And I'm like, yeah, man. He's like, are you on the run or something? And I'm like, no, why? And he's like, you just don't look like the kind of guy that would do this type of job. And so at that point, I told him everything. You know, everything we've talked about today, I told him everything. And he looks at me. He's like, man, I don't know. I'm going to have to think about it. So I go back home. That was a Friday evening. I go back home. He calls me Sunday evening. His name was Dustin DeRamus, and the name of the company was Landscape Renovations. And he gets me on the phone. And he's like, Brett, if I hire you, are you actually going to work? And I was like, Dustin, if you'll hire me, I'll work my ass off. So he's like, come out here tomorrow morning. So I show up next morning, and my job was pushing a lawnmower 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, $400 a week. And I busted my ass, man. I mean, I did. I busted my ass. I'd come in of a night, pass out, wake up the next morning, take a shower, hit it again. But I was damn happy to do it. I mean, it felt good to do that. And what happened was, it gets cold. Grass doesn't grow. Job ends. And that reason I commit crime, you know, I gotta show Michelle that I'm worth it. That pops up. She's all in one working. I've got to show my value in this. So I get it in my head that, you know, if nothing else, I can bring food in the house, get on the dark web, get some stolen credit cards, start ordering food, look at the two boys that are in the house. And I'm like, well, shit, I can also provide the clothes that they need, anything else that we need. So I get arrested picking up food. And here's the thing, for those who don't know, when I say picking up food, I'm not talking about bologna and bread. When you're stealing food, why would you steal bologna if you can steal steaks and crab? So that was it. All right. Yeah, that's this guy. But I get picked up stealing food. Michelle had no idea what I was doing. And that's when she finds out, because I had lied to her too. And at my sentencing, the only people that's there, the judge is there, U.S. Marshals, prosecutor, probation officer, me and Michelle. Michelle stands up and she tells the judge that I'm a better dad to her kids than their father is. Probation officer stands up and he's like, we think he's a good guy. We think it's a one-time thing. Prosecutor agrees with that. Judge gives me 12 months. Probation officer stands back up and he's like, Your Honor, if you can give Mr. Johnson a year and a day, he can get the good time and get back to his family. So the judge amends the sentence to a year and a day. So I only do 10 months. I go back to Texas. And that's when I find out that that Michelle didn't need me for what I could give her. She just wanted me for me that entire time. And that's what I'm saying. I never had that before. That's the first healthy relationship I'd ever been involved in. I do my 10 months. Get out. They kill probation so I can get a job now. We get married. And I'm no longer on probation. But the thing is I can't get a job. You know, they tell you, if nothing else, you can sell a car. No, you can't. You can sell a car if you're a drug dealer. If you're the guy that steals everyone's identities and credit cards and stealing cash and laundering money, they ain't going to hire you to sell a car. So here I am. I can't get a job at all. And I know, even today, Wade, I know what my triggers are. I know what it takes for me to go back and commit crime. And back then, I knew I'd go so long before I did it again. Looked at Michelle and let me see what I can do, you know, famous last words. And ended up signing on to LinkedIn, reached out to this FBI super cop named Keith Malarski. he was involved in a lot of the arrests of people that I knew, and sent him a message. I was like, hey, man, I think you did a great job. No hard feelings. Got nothing but respect for you. By the way, I'd like to be legal. And this guy, he got back with me within 2 hours. And he took me in under his wing. He gave me references, gave advice, told me what I needed to do. He retired. Shit, he retired, I think, 3-4 years ago. Works over at EY now. And still does that to this day. The guy does. So that was the start of it, man. From there, it was head of CNP, the Card Not Present Group. She hires me to come in and keynote a speech. Microsoft hears about that. They come in and hire me to as a consultant. AARP hears about that. They hire me as an ambassador. Today, I speak across the planet. Got this show that I do. I'm the guy who wrote Argo is writing the book right now. So that's probably due out next year. I've been on Netflix, on Hulu. I mean, I lead a very blessed life that I damn sure don't deserve, but I am damn grateful to have. And I take it very seriously. I do. Because I really do feel that I am completely blessed. And I take it very seriously about trying to help people and businesses from that type of person that I used to be. So I wake up in the morning doing my thing, and I go to sleep of the night doing that same damn thing. Because I don't want to be remembered as a guy who stole everything. I want to be remembered as a guy who was able to turn it around.
And so give it back.
Yeah, that's Brett Johnson.
Wow. What were you on Netflix?
Netflix, I'm on Web of Make-Believe, episodes 5 and 6. I'm the guy that talks about that Beanie Baby story, and they got an actor that plays me going to Disney World and ripping off the Secret Service from inside their offices. Yeah. They got that. Then on Hulu, I'm on Black Market season 2, episode 1. You know, the host of that, he used to be on The Wire. He overdosed right before they premiered season 2.
Oh yeah. You're talking about Michael K. Williams.
Michael K. Williams.
Yeah. Yes. Wow. Yeah. Okay. I remember watching. So I think one of them I was watching, it was like counterfeit stuff that they were bringing in, purses, right, shoes, things like that.
That was a good show.
It was good.
Yeah. I love Michael Williams.
Yeah. He was a hell of an actor, man. Could play a lot of different roles. I mean, he's widely known for his role as Omar in The Wire, but he's played a lot of different things, man. He was.
Yeah. He's great.
Very, very talented actor.
So, man, that was it, man.
That's an amazing story, dude. And I mean, just to be able to do all that at any point in time, you know, someone could just throw it in and hang it up. And that shows us that you have to persevere through that. And that's not easy. That's not something everybody can do. So you got to hang your hat on that.
It has been a long trip. It has been. And I've been hard headed. I mean, some people may get it, you know, first or second try, not this guy. Yeah. So it took a while, but, what I will say, I'll say, you know, the people that I was involved with, when we were committing crime, you had to know every single aspect of the crime that you were committing. You had to know how to use the tools, sometimes how to build the tools. You had to know the security of the companies you were trying to compromise. You had to know how to run drop addresses. You had to know how to launder money out. You had to know how to secure your own anonymity online, things like that. That's changed these days. So when I talk about crime, I talk about it from a point of experience, and I'm not the only guy that can do that. I'm very good though about being able to put it into simple terms for people.
Right.
These days though, most criminals, they really have no understanding of the dynamics of the crime that they're committing, because crime's now gotten to the point where online crime, all the products and services are off the shelf. You don't have to know anything about the security of the company you're trying to compromise. You don't have to know how to make a fake ID or run a drop address or launder money out or use a SOX 5 proxy or RDPs or anything else like that. It's done for you all of a sudden. So things have changed. To give you an idea, and this is one of the things that your viewers may find interesting. When Shadow Crew gets shut down in 2004, October 26, we ended with 4,000 members. Fast forward to 2017, the largest criminal group is called Alphabay. Law enforcement shuts it down, 240,000 members. Fast forward two more years to 2019, just a dark web marketplace called Black Market is shut down, 1.15 million members. So you see this growth that's going on. Today, you've got just single communities that are millions of members large. And the reason for that is because the ease of the crime has increased. Cybercrime as a service is absolutely a thing. Meanwhile, law enforcement, you know, you've got the FBI has 37,000 field agents across 56 field offices, and only about 200 of them concentrate on cybercrime. So the numbers are absolutely stacked against the good guys. At the same time, you've got security companies that they want to profit. So unless they're profiting, they're probably not going to come out with a security product that's going to do a hell of a lot of good for you.
Right.
So you've got all these issues, jurisdictional issues at the same time, all that comes into play. When I talk to people about protecting yourself, I recommend the top three things: freeze the credit, every single person in the house, monitor your accounts, place alerts on those accounts where you can, and then make sure you're practicing good password security. From there, you can do multi-factor, things like that as well. But those top three things are what everyone needs to do out of the gate.
Yeah, I got hit not too long ago. I guess someone somehow or another got into my Venmo account.
And that'll happen.
I didn't check it as regularly as I should have. Right. And I would have seen those two small few cent deposits that they usually do to verify.
Right.
And I guess because they went through, they verified them. Then the next thing you know, I was sending Joe Blow in Kentucky somewhere $700, $701, yeah. $702, $703, on up until right. It had just drained my whole damn account.
Now, did PayPal back you on that or not?
My bank did. It wasn't through PayPal. Okay. It was my Venmo account that was hooked up to my bank. And my bank did reimburse me.
So the bank covered it.
Okay. Because I told her, she's like, well, these weren't you? And I was like, does it look like that was something I would do? Like, is that, actually, I think it was in reverse. It started out higher. It was like right. 700, then it went to 699. It was always like a dollar lower all the way until it just completely depleted. And then I think they paid a credit card account. They paid a Chase account. So I was just like, geez, and I don't know how the hell they got it. I got no clue to this day how they had it. So I had to change accounts, which was a hassle, and, you know, do all that. But luckily, that's the only time I've ever been gotten.
Well, stay safe out there, man. Yeah. You know, that's the thing.
One question I wanted to ask you about before we get out of here, the Silk Road, when was that kind of at his height? I know that's kind of not exactly what you're doing, but this guy is parlayed into it a little bit.
It is. So what Ross does with Silk Road, so Silk Road, I think, shut down 2011-ish.
Right.
All right. So the thing about Silk Road is Silk Road is really the first successful dark web marketplace. All right. So When I ran Shadow Crew, when we were doing that, we didn't have the dark web. The U.S. Navy builds the dark web, that Tor browser. It starts becoming a problem in 2006-ish. All right. Memo comes across the desk of the Secret Service office in Columbia saying, hey, you guys need to worry about that. The problem was that no one was really using that at that point in time. Tor, the dark web, that Tor browser is only effective the more people that use it, because at that point it becomes much speedier. Mm-hmm. Back then you couldn't use it at all because it was so slow. Over time, though, people figure out that they can host sites on Tor as well. All right. And what's so successful with that is it becomes very problematic to find out where the physical box is. So where that physical server is located. Ross comes in at a very opportune time. We had a couple of precursors to cryptocurrency with Shadow Crew. We had Liberty Reserve and we had eGold. So think of both of those as basically crypto minus the blockchain. All right. What Satoshi does with Bitcoin is he comes up with this distributed ledger system, which is highly successful. It's very good tech. That's the game changer all of a sudden. The problem with Bitcoin is it really didn't have a use case. You had that idiot that gives 10,000 of them for two pizzas. Yeah, but that's not a use case. The real use case for Bitcoin was Silk Road. So Ross comes up and he understands this. Ross is like, you know, what we can do is, because we need some sort of payment instrument, the only currency we're going to accept is Bitcoin. And he understood as well that when you're looking at tech that allows laundering money or anonymity, the first adoptees tend to be criminals. So he accepts Bitcoin on the dark web. And it goes like wildfire at that point in time. There's a reason that, yeah, the reason that Bitcoin right now is $30,000 dates back to Ross Ulbricht. Mm-hmm. Now, does he deserve prison time? I think he does. Does he deserve life in prison? I don't think he deserves life.
Yeah, because they got him for what? Trying to facilitate a murder or something like that? Or
allegedly. He evidently tried to have like 2 to 3 people killed. You know, of course, he forgot that old rule. No, there are no hitmen on the dark web. So he looks for one, and what he finds is a law enforcement officer. Of course he does. So law enforcement officer, from what I understand, uses ketchup or some bullshit like that, puts on the guy, takes a couple of pictures. We killed him. And that's what happens. So Ross ends up with 2 life sentences plus 40 years. He gets one of the life sentences taken off, but he's still got life plus 40. You know, will he ever get out? Probably not.
What is the biggest thing that keeps Brett Johnson going back to what would draw him back before? I know you mentioned your triggers earlier.
Yeah.
But what is the biggest thing that keeps you from going? Because there's nothing, if anybody has ever gambled or pulled off any sort of a scam like that, there's the money, the movie Color of Money with Paul Newman and Tom Cruise. And he says money won is twice as sweet as money earned. And I believe that. But that also lends itself to someone that's doing a scam like you. When you get that big hunk of money and you really didn't do much of nothing, there's got to be a feeling that you get. What keeps you from acting on that feeling now?
And that's a damn good question. And I do have temptation. I absolutely do. All right. It's not like I'm not still skilled with this stuff. But the way I handle temptation is, If there's some crime that appeals to me, like pandemic fraud, you know, the unemployment fraud that was going on, I will talk about it. I will get it out and do a show about it, something like that. That tends to take care of that. Plus, I'll mention it to my FBI contacts at the same time. So that helps. But really what keeps me in line is it started out with a support group. You know, I've never been in my history in life. I have never been the guy that bows down to peer pressure ever. But I've surrounded myself with so many people, and they've looked out for me, man. You know, not only that, but the people who initially come out, like Keith Malarski, Carice Hendrick, the people over at Microsoft, people at AARP, they put their names, their reputations on the line for somebody that they had no idea if they could trust me or not. They just thought maybe they could. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when your actions can absolutely influence somebody else's life like that, when you understand that, hey, if you screw up, it's not just you that's screwing up. You're fucking these people over too. That makes a world of difference. And then I think back to the pandemic, because I was really concerned when COVID hit that I was going to go back to crime. You know, my consulting was ending. They were ending conferences out the wazoo, everything else. And I mentioned it to my wife, my kids, to the FBI, to people in the industry as well. And it was like everybody just kind of circled around and they would check on me. You know, I'd get this call from FBI every couple of 3 weeks. Hey, you doing okay? Let's have lunch. But I'd also get called, you know, people would check on me on LinkedIn. They called me up. Hey, how's everything going, Brett? Everything going all right? And it was like, you know, when you get that, when you get that level of somebody caring about you, it makes a world of difference. And then at the same time, this whole trajectory that I've had, I mean, I was top of the heap on the bad guy side, you know, and I've been given this opportunity to turn things around. And I do take that seriously. That's not to say that I'm not tempted. I am tempted. I absolutely am. But the good far outweighs the bad on all of that. You know, this is the, unless you've been there, Wade, it's hard to really appreciate, you know, by all rights, I should be in prison, man. I should be in prison. By all rights, I should have gotten out and did the same damn thing again and got 20 years and been forgotten about. But I'm that lucky son of a bitch that, you know, through my sister, wife, FBI, and then the cybersecurity industry that didn't look down on me, but just kind of opened their arms and said, hey, yeah. Yeah, we'll give you a shot. You know, that makes a world of difference, man. It does.
Well, I firmly believe if you've made it through all that and you did get that break to make it to where you are now, it's for a reason.
Yeah.
And I believe that you're living that out right now, because I've always put it like this. My wife's a school counselor.
Okay.
And she didn't have necessarily the best upbringing. She's seen a lot of things she shouldn't have, went through a lot of things she shouldn't have, but that allows her to be able to talk to these kids and they can spot bullshit. And when you've been through something, there is no better teacher of things like that than somebody that's been through it. If I'm going somewhere and I want to hear about cyber conferences or, you know, cyber crime, I don't want to hear a guy that went and took a course at a college and can tell me this, that. I want to hear what you just told me.
I mean, it's true.
You're going to hold my attention. So there is a place and an avenue, I think, that is, you know, going to be your niche here going forward. And I believe you're already in it. So there's no need for me to tell you that that's it. Keep going. I think you already know that.
I appreciate it, man. Truly.
Where can our listeners find you, your show, any sorts of social medias, things like that?
Well, look, I'm the guy, you know, my show, the Brett Johnson Show, it's on YouTube, it's on Spotify, it's on iTunes, it's wherever you get your content. Now that being said, a lot of my show is basically therapy for Brett. So I do cybersecurity. I talk about cybercrime. I do that. I've been interviewing criminals not to talk about crime, but to talk about how they turn their lives around.
Right.
All right. I do a lot of therapy type stuff, because think of it like this. My show is a therapeutic show that's kind of clothed in a cybersecurity and cybercrime veneer is what it is. And it's about me trying to figure out how to be a better guy by talking to people, by getting these things out as well. So that's my show. So you can contact me on that. You can watch me on that. You can find me every day on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter under Gollum Fun or Brett Johnson, either one. You will see I bitch about a lot of stuff. I call out, criminals all the time. I call out all the people in corporations that are doing bad. I'm the guy that says the shit that no one else will say is what I am. Sometimes you're going to like what I say. Sometimes you ain't. Either way, I'm going to say it. And sometimes I may even get banned from YouTube.
Oh boy.
It's happened before.
I remember you telling me about that. I'm hoping not to get on that list. Cause I believe 100% of what you're saying is when you go through something like that, especially if you're facing, you know, a lengthy prison sentence or something like that, these podcasts can be very therapeutic. That's worked great for me. And then I've guessed it on other shows where I've told, you know, my story, and being able to talk to someone that can understand, not maybe necessarily every detail, but just either the prison aspect or the pressure that it put on you. I can talk with somebody like that better than I can a shrink that have never been through anything like that in their life. The worst thing they ever had is a speeding ticket. So I understand what you're saying.
You know, it's about being truthful, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, you know, your show, my show, I'm not trying to be anybody else. You're not trying to be anybody else. You just be yourself, be truthful. I think as long as you're truthful, that, and I don't have a lot of followers. I don't. But the followers that I have absolutely love the shit out of me, and I love the shit out of them too. And it's because I'm truthful. They know that. They're truthful with me in return. I think that's all you can ask at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Well, Brett, this has been a fantastic episode, man. I certainly appreciate you coming on and sharing a bit about your story. And when that book comes out, let us know. We'll put it out. Because trust me, we've only just scratched the surface here of everything that you got to say. There's a whole lot more that's out there. So I encourage everybody when that drops to definitely go out and pick that book up for sure.
Wade, stay safe. Thank you so much for having me on, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you, my brother. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I am Hollywood Wade. That was Brett Johnson. And unfortunately, we are out of time. Tune in next week for an all new episode of Crime and Entertainment. Brett, we appreciate it, my friend.
Yes, sir.
God almighty, what a story that was. Brett Johnson is a character and a half, folks. I really enjoyed having him on there. I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. Go check him out in the socials, folks. All of his stuff is below, tagged in the YouTube and the show notes. Go give him a follow, sub to his channel as well. If you like that type of content, I'm sure you'll love it. Very, very, very funny guy. I'll probably have to have him back on here at some point, because that was an absolute blast of an interview. If you enjoyed it, head on over to YouTube, like, subscribe, hit that notification bell. That way you get notified every time we drop a video. Also, we're available everywhere you get your audio podcasts, folks. That's Spotify, that's Apple, that's Amazon Music. That's Google. And of course, we're all over your socials, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. We are everywhere. So make sure you give us a follow, like, share, subscribe, share the show on your social medias, folks. We put out clips daily. So if one catches your eye, go back and, check out the episode if it's one you may have missed, but also share it on the socials. That's the easiest, quickest, and most helpful thing you can do to help this show. We hope everyone is enjoying the content. We're going to keep coming out with it weekly. I just can't thank everybody enough for tuning in. It's really been a treat. I'm enjoying the hell out of these. I hope you are too. That'll do it for this episode of Crime and Entertainment. I'm Hollywood Wade, and that was Brett Johnson. See you next week.